located. The court has flipped this morning as the occasion for argument is a case filed as Ronnie Holden against the state of Indiana. The appellant, Mr. Holden, is represented this morning by Greg Bowles. Good to have you. He's assisted by Ann Sutton. Nice to see you. The appellee, state of Indiana, is represented by Gary Seacrest of the Attorney General's office. And he is assisted by a member of the student body, Andrew Falk. Nice to see you. As counsel knows, the court has allowed an hour for this argument, 30 minutes for each side. Mr. Holden will have the chance to open and close. Mr. Bowles, you may proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Mr. Associate Justices. My name is Greg Bowes, and I represent Ronnie Holden. I want to remind the court that I was trial counsel for Mr. Holden as well. I've asked the court to reserve 7 minutes for rebuttal, if that's all right. Today we're here to determine the scope and effect of Article 1, Section 19. That particular section of the Indiana Constitution asks three questions that need to be determined by this court. First, what is the appropriate strength, scope, and effect of the section? Second, what should a trial judge instruct a jury about with regard to that particular section? And lastly, what should counsel be allowed to argue to the jury after before the case is finished? I'd like to talk a little bit about the history behind the making of that section and suggest to the court current, valid public policy reasons why this particular section should be revitalized and brought back to full life and the full strength that the founders wanted. Our jury system goes back to the Magna Carta, where the king unwillingly accepted the will of the people to say that whenever the power of government is imposed on any of the people, that cannot be done without the consent of the people themselves. We have post-mediaeval case where William Penn and William Meade were accused of preaching to a public assembly religious views that differed from the Anglican Church. The jury in that case refused to convict, even in spite of admissions that there were statements made in public and that they were preaching a different religion. The jury was held in contempt, held without food, water, fire, until they came back with a verdict that the court agreed with. The jury still refused. They were held in contempt and held in prison until they could pay their contempt fines. It wasn't until their habeas corpus petition was presented to the Court of Common Pleas and Lord Justice Vaughan freed them of their contempt citation and put in place our respect for the jury system and their absolute right to refuse to convict when justice requires their conscience to refuse. We take that into our own American history. In pre-colonial times, the court's probably familiar with the trial of John Peter Zenger, where he was charged with sedition for publishing comments critical of the colonial governor, and Andrew Hamilton successfully urged jury nullification in his closing argument. That is the groundwork for what happened in Indiana. The Indiana Constitution was developed in 1816. In that Constitution, there was a provision that said, in prosecutions for libel, truth shall be an absolute defense, and in those cases, the jury will have the right to determine both the law and the facts, and then they added the words, as in other cases. Now, jump forward to when we held a constitutional convention in 1851. There was a discussion about what should we do with the old Constitution, what tinkering must we do to make this work better. They took that particular provision of the 1816 Constitution and broke it into two parts. The first one said that in any case involving prosecution of libel, their truth shall be an absolute defense. And I think they anticipated that would be both for criminal cases and civil, and that was part of the debate of the Constitution.
Do you contend, counsel, that Section 19, the primary principle of Section 19 is jury nullification, or do those words, the jury shall have the right, to determine the facts in the law, have any essential meaning beyond that?
I think it's a very broad meaning that suggests that the jury is the final say on whether the application of the rules of government are just under the facts of the case. So whether that means nullification or whether that means they are the final say of whether the laws work, I think it's all included.
Would they have the power, under your understanding, to find that in the criminal case, the charges against the defendant and the proof that's presented is such that they think that their interpretation of the law, their findings of the law, find that they ought to reject some things that they're told by the court about, for example, the presumption of innocence or other things that they think are, since we're to determine the law, we put our interpretation on what that really means, and so we're going to convict, even though it is not that decision would not be supported by the evidence or the law.
If I understand the court's question right, how does this provision protect against jurors from convicting the innocent? Is that part of the question?
Well, that's part of the question, yes. I'm basically wondering about how do we apply Section 19 fairly to both the state and the defense? The jury has the right to find the law in favor of the defense. Why can't they find the law in favor of the state?
Right. I don't believe that the design of the section is intended to apply equally or symmetrically to both the state and the defense. I think that this is a particular right that is designed to protect people accused of crimes.
Is there any history to support that?
We have the development of the history along the lines of we have the right of the trial judge, to enter a directed verdict of acquittal. We have appellate review. We have our due process rights. And in fact, in the Maryland situation, a lot of the debate, since Maryland has a similar provision in its constitution, a lot of the debate centered on the idea of how does that constitutional provision jive with the federal due process rights, such as presumption of innocence and reasonable doubt. And they had a big fight over that because in Maryland, the judges were saying, our description of the law is not mandatory on you, and if you choose to accept it, that's fine. So there were challenges from the defense side that suggested that we should not be able to say that when that conflicts with the supreme federal due process right. So
let me pursue that due process argument with you. In your brief, you do talk about a state and federal constitution guarantee of a right of jail application. I'm not sure if I quite understand your federal claim. As I understand it, the federal courts in a long series of opinions have rejected that argument outright and have done so for a number of years. So I'm not sure if I understand the federal constitution reference, but the second part of that is this, and it goes back to something Justice Dixon said, and that is this notion of nullification. Maybe we should pin that down, because there's something different between nullification, if we understand nullification meaning the jury can simply disregard the law, don't have to follow it at all. It seems to me that's one concept, versus what you appear to be arguing in your brief, which is, no, the jury should be instructed that they can not follow the law's harshness where justice so requires. It seems to me that's a different proposition. So we can A, address the constitutional, federal constitution issue within this notion of nullification.
I think that's part of the difficulty of the issue. With regard to the federal law, I think that the notion of jury nullification is still a valid concept now. The question is, what do you instruct the jury and what should you allow counsel to argue? What is clear from federal law is that there is absolutely no review of a jury's decision to acquit.
Well, that's the same under the state.
That's correct.
Make that a distinction, doesn't it?
That's right. But I think that is so closely related to the idea of deciding not to convict on the basis of justice or leniency or considerations of the policies behind a particular set of laws. And in addition, there is the idea that there's no way to challenge a jury's decision under the federal jurisprudence when they acquit. But additionally, there are the protections in place that say if a jury convicts when the evidence does not support it, the trial judge has the right to direct the verdict. The appeals courts have the right to acquit based on a lack of sufficiency of the evidence.
That doesn't work very well, Mr. Bowes, for the reason that a jury that decides to convict, let's say, on less than proof beyond a reasonable doubt, will not be second-guessed by a trial judge or an appellate court for the reason that their action will only take place if there is no evidence. So there would be, under the regime you describe, it seems to me, a whole class of defendants who fall in between those two things. Let's say a jury that thinks maybe 53% probability of guilt exists, decides to convict anyway. That person's still going to sit in jail, isn't she?
I think I see the gap there that the court's referring to, and I agree that that's a possibility. We have standards of review on the directed verdict level and at the appellate level that limit the ability of those judicial functions to protect the innocent from being convicted unduly. But what I think are proper placements to protect against that are also the requirements that no one in the courtroom, the prosecutor or the defense counsel, misstate these fundamental due process rights. So we should not have anyone suggesting to the jury that there is no reasonable doubt burden of proof. There should be no one suggesting that there is not a presumption of innocence. So we have an interplay between the trial court instructing on what the law is, and yet the jury being allowed to say, on today's date, under the facts of this case, we do not believe a conviction is just.
Well, let me pursue that with you. What difference is it between the jury saying, we've heard the instructions on reasonable doubt, instructions you say they'd be obliged to follow, I'm still not sure I understand why the instruction would send that message to them, and a jury that says, the judge has told us that burglary is a Class C felony. That seems awfully harsh to us today. We're sure that he did it beyond a reasonable doubt. We decided to acquit him anyway. Why do those two instructions on the law stand on a different footing with you?
I think that's in the wording in the instruction. The instruction I tendered at trial included the words that said, you're not allowed to make new law. You're not allowed to ignore the law. You should give the instructions of the court respectful consideration. You are not allowed to return a false verdict. Those were things that I put in my standard instruction that the trial court refused.
What would be false about the hypothetical that I gave you? What would not be false about the hypothetical I gave you? A jury is told the elements of burglary, told that it's a Class C felony, is convinced by the evidence beyond reasonable doubt that the defendant did the crime, and issues a verdict that is not a verdict. Verdict does not tell the truth. It tells the world that this person is acquitted.
I don't believe that that's a false verdict because of the hierarchy of who's in charge of making the decision. We have Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution that says all power is inherent in the people. We have an unreviewable discretion for the jury to refuse to convict and not be required to give us a reason. So what that says to me is that we have developed a system that, as part of our checks and balances, not only do we have a judiciary, a legislative, and an executive branch, but we have the people weighing in. And Article 1, Section 1 says that the people are the primary responsibility for determining what is right and wrong. So
it is a pretty small slice of the people, isn't it?
It's a group of
6 or 12. I put it to you that the law also is there by act of the people. That is to say, they send their elected representatives to Indianapolis. They make the decisions about whether burglary should be a crime, and maybe 2 million of them go to the polls to do that. This is a form of sort of counter-democratic lawmaking, isn't it? We say to the jury, it's okay with us if today you decide that burglary isn't a crime.
Yes, and the reason that I believe our founders wanted that veto power, let's call it, in place is because legislatures cannot anticipate every particular set of circumstances and describe whether it's proscribed or prescribed. They cannot know what's going to happen on every occasion. This particular function allows the jury to come in and say, under these facts, we agree with burglary being a crime, but there's something about today in these facts that says we should not apply that generalized law to this particular set of circumstances.
It actually takes one of them to say that, doesn't it?
That is correct.
Not even the six people have to agree, and that leads to the point I'm really concerned about. Burke Marshall, one of the leading civil rights litigators of the Kennedy and Johnson administration, has said that these instructions in the 20th century primarily served to acquit whites for violence on blacks. That is to say, you put in the jury comes in, they hear the evidence, and one of the jurors says, I just think it's too harsh to find somebody guilty of burglary for beating up an African American in the street, and refuses to vote. That's what actually has happened in these cases during the 20th century. And you could posit the same thing with respect to gay people. Very, very real-life situations in which members of the jury, as I understand it, would be told that it was okay for them to decide that the law was too harsh to criminalize assault on gay members of the community. Do you accept that as a cost of the other benefits that you see? Because it seems to me very plausible that Burke Marshall is right, that jury nullification instructions have served primarily to empower the single racist on the jury or the single homophobe on the jury who says, I'm simply not going to acquit because I think it's too harsh to hold a white person guilty under these circumstances.
I don't know that we should just focus on those anomalies. I think to answer the court's question, it is an acceptable cost, and there's a reason for that. When you compare it to the times when that single juror held out and courageously stood up to an injustice, then I think we have a situation where we are placing the balance of power right at the right point. We have many situations where unjust acts were tried to be imposed against people. We have the fugitive slave laws, where it was a crime to harbor a runaway slave from the South. We had the Navigation Act, where we were required to trade in a certain way, and juries refused to convict on those because they were unjust laws. We had a dispute over the Vietnam War in the late 60s and the early 70s, where protesters were committing actual crimes, such as destroying draft records, and yet the higher justice of the whole war and the rightness of the war was being challenged in each prosecution. And those jurors were saying, under these facts, sure, we agree that nobody should go in and burn down the government records, but under these circumstances today, we feel that it's unjust to take action against these people because they had a higher calling. Now, what does that mean over the evolution of time? The evolution of the law is helped by these statements by these single jurors or a group of jurors that says, today I will not allow that prosecution to go forward and result in a conviction when it's in my name. Now,
maybe this all goes back to there is this provision in Indiana's Constitution that in all criminal cases the jury shall determine the law. And the question is, what does that mean? That is the question.
Yes.
And I guess my question to you is, at the time that provision was written, of course, there were no debates, they really didn't say what it means. What is the other plausible meaning outside of that the jury may not enforce or has the right not to enforce the harsh of the law here, justice so dictates? What other plausible explanation could this notion of the jury has the right to determine the law have? What other plausible explanation is there, and what would be your source for it?
Well, there's certainly a spectrum in the debate over this issue, but I would suggest that it has a jury determining the law first has the right to put its stamp of whether this particular prosecution under these facts is just.
Well, it uses the word determine, doesn't it? Not make up or create.
That's
or,
correct.
And doesn't determine suggest some quasi-scientific exercise, obviously with some imprecision? In other words, it's supposed to find something. It's not supposed to just conjure it up.
That's right. But
if that's the case, what's wrong with having instructions guiding a jury in the complex world we live in the 21st century? After all, we've got an 1851 provision here when the entire set of Burns was encased in the three volumes of the 1852
right.
code.
I think
it was a better time.
Yeah. I think it's important to give guidance. And the failure in the trial court's instructions in Mr. Holden's case was that the instruction merely said, you have a right to determine the law and the facts, and the jury was left hanging. So I think some instruction is required.
If we think about it, I mean, it also says you have the right to determine the facts.
Yes.
And when it determines the facts, it listens to witnesses, discards for reasons of credibility some, accepts other facts by way of these different witnesses. So if you use that as a parallel, then what would be determining the law if you think about it in terms of what the jury does in determining the facts? What would they do in determining the law?
The jury would be treating the trial court's instructions the same as it would the witnesses. The witnesses are presenting facts. The trial court is presenting its view of the law. And that view is going to be based on case law, statutes, constitutional provisions. And we would expect the trial court to recount those things fairly and accurately. And to the extent the judge does instruct fairly and accurately, we should expect that juries are going to accept that as the law because they do not have the higher training. But there are times when the legislature could not have anticipated a particular set of circumstances. The judge is correctly stating the law, yet there's something unjust about imposing that prosecution on under those facts.
Do you agree that the federal due process clause, the 14th Amendment, imposes some limits on what the jury can determine to be the law? For example, can we agree that it would be a violation of the 14th Amendment to convict somebody if the jury came in and said, we simply don't find element A of this crime, but we're convicting anyway?
I think that should be in place. And, in fact, that is the kind of predicament that Maryland has wrestled with. Up until recently, Maryland was instructing on the law and then always putting a proviso in there and said, oh, but these are advisory discussions of the law only. You can do whatever you want. And what the effect of that was is defendants were coming in and challenging those instructions because they opened up the right of the jury to ignore the federal due process requirements, which are superior under the supremacy clause.
Okay, I'll take that as a yes. Now, my next question is... Assuming that's the case, we have a much more developed body of federal due process law today than we had in 1851 when there was literally none applicable to the states. We didn't have the 14th Amendment. And doesn't the evolution of the 14th Amendment constraints on the jury give us some guidance as to what determined means too and make it more plausible to make it a door that swings both ways that requires the jury to follow appropriate instructions, not just as a matter of...
I think there's a difference between telling the jury what to do or what not to do and laying the law in front of them and, as Justice Rucker is suggesting, letting them choose from what's fair and just in the particular circumstances and doing nothing. It all will depend on the language of the instruction, I suggest. So the instruction that says you determine the law and that's the end of that leaves them hanging. They don't know what the strength of their power is or their right is. Telling them they cannot do this and cannot do that limits them too much. I suggest that we let them have an understanding that they are allowed to determine the justness of the law in its application under those facts.
Well, there was a corollary in the federal side for probable cause, the reasonable doubt, where in some instances the court in some circuits specifically say you must find guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, but are specifically instructed not to define it.
Correct.
Is that something that would be, do you think we could pursue in this particular instance? Just say you have a right to determine the law and not pursue this notion of trying to define what that means?
I think that I just want to point out to the court that the initial time has expired. And I'd like to answer the question if you'd like.
Go ahead.
But I think we have the job before us of determining exactly what the instructions should say. And I think there's a spectrum that we can choose from. One that tells them nothing. The worst end of the spectrum I see is when we tell them all these things they cannot do, and they walk away thinking, oh, good grief, all I need to do is look at the facts, when in fact our Constitution says they determine the law as well. Then you go along the spectrum toward just tell them you have the right to determine the law, and then they know nothing about what that means. And as we get further and further toward empowering them to do things that we don't want them to do, we would start saying, well, you can ignore any law, and our instructions are advisory only. I think somewhere between telling them just the words of the Section 19 and telling them the thing that, and telling them they can do whatever they want and making it an advisory court instruction is where we should land. And I think the best way to do that is in my proposal by telling them they have the right to choose to refuse to convict when the justice of the case requires it. And I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Mr. Gross, before you sit down, I'd like to try to get one question in here if I could. This goes back to something you said a little bit earlier. Almost in passing, you said that, I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, but that it would be unconstitutional to disregard or to set aside a jury verdict of acquittal. Do you think that that's a matter of state constitutional law? It would violate the state constitution for the court to set aside a jury verdict of acquittal?
I think that's a matter of case law, both at the federal and the state level.
So you would say there's no, you would find no state constitutional right to a defendant to be acquitted if the jury returned a verdict of acquittal.
The best I can do on that is the suggestion that the due course of law, the open courts provision, incorporates a due process concept that says we should do what we understand to be due process.
But this court has said that doesn't apply to criminal law, right? So that doesn't help you. I guess my question is, could it be that all that Article 1, Section 19 says is that a court is required to accept a verdict of acquittal in a criminal case, that it can't set aside a jury verdict of acquittal?
I think that's part of the range of choices this court has, and I would suggest it needs to be broader than that, because the strength of the historical context for that provision is much stronger than that. And then when you incorporate Section 19,
well, is it? I mean, think about the William Penn case. The William Penn jury wants to acquit, and the court says, "I won't accept a verdict of acquittal if we said that the right to determine the law and the facts meant that a court had to accept a verdict of acquittal." That would take care of your principal historical precedent, wouldn't it?
That would.
There's
one.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gross. Mr. Seeger.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, all of the defendant's attempts to invite jury nullification through voir dire and instruction and argument were properly denied because nullification forms no right or proper exercise of the jury's authority and power under Article 1, Section 19. The framework of a constitutional analysis has been expressed by this court in its 91 decision in Bayh versus Sonnenberg and Price versus State in 1993. One of the bases of that analysis is to look at the history and the background to determine the old law, the mischief, and the remedy that was proposed, and what it meant at that time and what it should mean at this time. That examination in this case, we are fortunate, has been undertaken already by Justice Rucker in his Law Review article and by a very good article by Carolyn Stenger called The Jury's Role Under the Indiana Constitution and the Indiana Law Journal in 1977. I will not even attempt to improve on that analysis, but to give you the state's observations on the same material surveyed in those articles. The juries were instituted originally as a protection of the subject against the monarch, as protection from suffering a penalty without the facts being found. Soon after that, the juries were given the power to decide the law, because, as it's been explained, the jurors suffered retaliation or judicial coercion if they returned a verdict other than as they were directed. It was held in Bushell's case that the jury general verdict of acquittal could not work an injury or could not work an attainder against the jury. Neither could it affect a retrial of the defendant. The evil at that time, we must remember, was tyranny of the crown and the court, and probably both. There was also the added mischief or disadvantage that many jurists were unlearned. The victim in that situation was the citizen, and the jury was placed in the breach. However, because of the early development of double jeopardy, the jury became the primary victim. Therefore, the jury was given this protection that its verdict could not work a jeopardy against it, could not subject it to coercion or any sort of judicial process if they acquit against a directed verdict or acquit at all. It was never a question of the defendant's right to argue nullification. Those cases in all of these surveys, and as explained by the Supreme Court in its Sparf decision, is not a discussion of the right to argue nullification. It's the right of the jury to nullify and what happens to the jury if they do. Today, we've retained that remedy even when the jury violates its oath or rules against the law in exchange for the benefit of the protection. I would submit that the right of the jury to determine the law under our Constitution and that is historically developed protects two values: that in criminal cases, the jury will apply the law to the facts, not the judge. And so no man will suffer a criminal penalty without a jury having found and applied the law to the facts. This is not merely guaranteed by a right to trial by jury, because there is no guarantee, just in those simple words, that the law will be determined by the jury as well as the facts. The second value is that the jury's decision for acquittal on any basis will not subject the jury to any coercion, retaliation, or penalty. This is a right of the jury. The primary core value is the rule of law and not man. I think this is consistent with the findings of Justice Rucker in his article. The protection from judicial and executive tyranny, however, is no longer the mischief sought to be avoided or even necessary in this case, as it was and probably was not even soon after the founding of this nation. True, it's a protection of juries as well as the public, but it's a mechanism that works through and on the jury. The protections afforded the juror are accomplished by the finality of their acquittal. Protections afforded an accused are realized when the accused is tried by a jury and that jury applies the law to the facts. Anything that diminishes either of these protections is violative of our constitutional provision, for example, mandatory instructions. They presume to instruct the jury that the court is the final arbiter of the law, and that is not the case. I believe this is why the court has resolved finally in Beavers and some of the more recent expressions that this constitutional provision does not give the jury the right to make, repeal, ignore, disregard the law. The right, and therefore the responsibility of the jury, is to apply the law as it is to the facts. Anything more or less is an abrogation of their responsibility.
Mr. Seacrest, let me ask and ask you to help me understand one point that you were making. I understood you to say that there is no right to jury nullification. There is only protection of the jury if it unlawfully nullifies the facts or the conviction. Do you understand my question, and can you help me with that? Are you saying that there is, let me take any steps. First of all, is there a right of jurors to acquit, even though in their heart of hearts they are convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that the state has proved every element of the charge?
I would submit there is no right. There is a power, but there is no right. In essence, the question of nullification is it a right or a power?
Then if it's the truth, that the jury has the power to nullify.
Yes.
Why do you conceal the truth from the jury and not tell them that they have that power?
Because it is a power that we allow them to have because of the protection that provision provides. They should not be told or encouraged to go against their oath and decide the case on anything other than the law that is given to them and the facts that are presented to them. The fact that they, in their heart, may feel that they are perhaps obeying a higher law, whatever the source of their dissension is, should still be realized by them that they are violating the oath and they are not according their responsibility under the instructions.
But history gives us so many examples of very effective advocacy on behalf of the defense, in which Clarence Darrow obtained many an acquittal based upon an appeal to the jurors' social sense of fairness, and essentially saying, even though this might violate the law, this defendant needs to be acquitted. It's not fair. And even modern times, we have successful defenses that are based upon trying to place blame on the police investigation or trying to appeal to other values that a juror may have that have nothing to do with the facts of the case. And you're saying that that is not a basic embodiment of Anglo-American, at least American law?
It is certainly what some might consider a hallowed practice of American law, and in some cases it may in fact
work.
Be the only remedy for that one individual at that immediate time. However, it should, even if it is to be allowed, must not be seen as the rule. An encouragement and even a promotion of nullification works more mischief than it attempts to heal or cure.
In this case, the tendered instruction that was refused doesn't seem to go very far. It embodies all of the. In fact, it may be seen to be even more cautious than the instruction in Beavers that you find support in, and that most of our cases, admittedly up to now, have relied upon. But Beavers ultimately tells the jury, "You can go your own way. You can disregard the law." That's much more than the instruction presented in this case was. This instruction, all the way to that last line, is very conservative. It says, follow the law, no matter what. And then it ends this final little phrase, the one that apparently led the trial judge to reject it, which dealt with if there was an element of harsh, if there was...
In the phase two, I believe it's enforced the harshness of the law.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a much more limited approach to looking at Article Section 19 than even Beavers would. That seems pretty innocuous. Why is the jury, under your argument, being pushed to do something that's so heretical? This particular instruction doesn't seem to be that far-fetched, away from, and even more constraint than the Beavers instruction itself.
I think it's a matter of degrees. In both cases, the jury is being asked to nullify the application of the law, to nullify the instructions, to disregard, ignore them, repeal them. In the case, the fact that it is that they are invited to do it by an even more incorrect instruction in another case does not make this any less violative. I don't think this should be accorded the fact that it's the least offensive of the instructions to come down the way. In addition to the constitutional deficiency, I can mention that this instruction is wrong because it disparages the state and the law by it presumes that the law is harsh. It's just, are they going to decide in this case that the harshness will not be enforced, but in this case, the harshness, they find that justice in this case recommends that the law's harshness will be enforced. It is a fundamental principle that no instruction can either disparage the other side's defense or unduly heighten your own defenses, the other side's case. And in this case, it is definitely describing the law and the state's efforts here as harshness.
Well, let me pursue something also you said, which is true, that looking at a constitutional provision and attempting to assess what it means, you want to examine the evil time, et cetera, it is true, isn't it, that for Article 1, Section 19, there is no reported case, either by the Supreme Court of the state or the Court of Appeals, using that framework for analyzing Article 1, Section 19, doesn't exist. Would that be an accurate statement?
That's correct. There is no formal decision.
I ask you then, what, and given that maybe at the time of the Bushnell case, perhaps, the tyranny of the monarch may have been the root of that, but what is your notion of what was going on at the time that this constitutional provision in 1851, I believe it was, when it was written into this Constitution, certainly wasn't the tyranny of the monarch involved there. What do you think was happening that would have that would have inspired the framers to say, we're going to put this into Indiana's Constitution? What is your take on that?
Well, I think we have to understand that they're not actually putting something new in. They are deciding how to formulate the old provision into the new one. they did split it off into its own provision, and now it is no longer restricted to libel. And there is some indication, as you pointed out in your article, that that the common impression was that this was the law anyway. I don't know exactly what would have convinced these Jacksonian Democrats that what evil or mischief they were attempting to cure, unless it was simply the preservation of the right of the jury to apply the law to the facts, and that the jury would feel safe to do that in a case where they acquit. That is not, this, the vitality and validity of this provision does not depend on it, on nullification. Nullification is not the lifeblood of this provision. Indiana, in the recent history, has certainly said that it is not, the even within the constitutional provision, but certainly Indiana has been applying it on mandatory instructions in other places. I think it's unwarranted to see in this provision more than what the simple language guarantees.
So what does it mean today? What is left of Article 1, Section 19? Does it have any purpose that is not served by due process or other provisions in the Constitution of our state? Does it mean anything today?
Well, due process will guarantee the
same. Well, due process, does Section 19 have any meaning?
Right.
Okay.
I was pointing out the due process has its provisions that are different than in this one. This provision, again, guarantees that in Indiana, only a jury will apply the law to the facts. You will not have a jury returning special verdicts on facts and the judge applying the law to them. You will also not have a jury who are compelled to return a directed verdict of conviction. And if they are the determiners of the law, if they are the ones that apply the law, then that is clearly inappropriate for a court to do.
Mr. Seekers, I have two different sets of questions. The Parker and CA cases that deal with habitual offender determinations, we've invoked Article 1, Section 19 there. Do you think those cases are consistent with the view of Article 1, Section 19 you've been propounding here this morning?
To the extent that Article 1, Section 19 insulates a jury from any consequence to acquitting or finding that...
Well, that's not really an issue in those cases, right?
No, acquitting, or at least declining to find that they are an habitual offender. Not acquitting in terms of the guilt phase, I misspoke, but that they will suffer no penalty for finding that, and they cannot have that decision taken away from them, as it used to be, where they were just given a special verdict to decide, are these two prior convictions unrelated in the right order and so forth? Does he have them? And then the judge would say, it's been found, and I will now apply the habitual offender. The jury in those cases, and I would submit still in habitual offenders, are obligated to apply the law to the facts. If they find the two priors, that they're unrelated and so forth, they should apply that law as it stands to those facts. The eventuality that they will decline to may be distinguishable because it is a status in the legislature anticipated or wanted the jury to make that final status determination, since it is not an application of an entire criminal scheme and elements and so forth to it. But in the end, we have to expect that in every time a jury is given that determination, that they will apply the law that they're instructed. I don't think that a special exception should be made for the jury's determination in one.
Sounds like you disagree then with the holdings of Parker and CA.
I don't, because the jury does have the power to decline to declare a defendant an habitual offender.
And well, they have that same power in terms of the power there, isn't it precisely the same power that's at stake when the jury is asked to decide whether a defendant is guilty of theft or burglary? Is there any distinction?
There is in the case that I suggested, in the situation that I suggested earlier, in that this is purely a status determination. There are no other ingredients for the jury to make except he does have the priors, they're unrelated, they're in the right order, the law is against him, and now the legislature...
So the power is the same, but the determination that's being made is different, right?
I would say it's qualitatively different. It's not the same thing as finding a person guilty of a crime. They have also
as opposed to a person having a certain status.
Correct, because they have also heard the entire evidence. They now know the appropriateness of this defendant. They have his priors. They know, is he the type of person that we think should be declared an habitual offender? They may not know the entire ramifications, but they know enough to know that that is a severe.
Yeah, well, I would suggest to you that the power is exactly the same, but the nature of the determination is fundamentally different.
I submit it may be.
The other thing I want to ask you about is this argument that you've made that one of the principal functions of Section 19 is to protect the jury from future retaliation. Would that be a fair way of saying it?
Correct.
Now let me ask you this: Suppose a juror is part of a panel that that votes to acquit a defendant in case number one. That juror is subsequently called for jury duty in case number 123, a year and a half later. Would you think that this Article 1, Section 19 protection that you described would make it impossible for a prosecutor to disqualify that juror from service on the subsequent jury for the cause that this juror voted to acquit in the prior case? In other words, is that juror protected from such a disqualification in a future case on the basis of this Article 1, Section 19 power that you mentioned?
I think that's very unlikely because nobody would know exactly what was the basis of the jury's determination unless there was something of an interview of the jurors.
Well, a question, Sullivan, have you ever served on a jury? Yes. Question two, what was the result of that jury? We voted to acquit the defendant. Your Honor, I moved to disqualify Juror Sullivan on the basis of cause. He's previously shown that he's favorable to criminal defendants. Answer, no, first Assistant Attorney General Sechrist says that Article 1, Section 19 protects jurors from any retaliation whatsoever for returning a verdict.
I really don't think that's an Article 1, Section 19 situation, as it is just an insufficient basis for cause challenge. The future retaliation, I guess I should say, should qualify that it's really immediate coercion to return the verdict that the court wants. That is what this particularly protects and immediately protects a juror from, that their acquittal will work them no jeopardy. At that time, they will not be coerced. They will not be imprisoned, attainted, until they return the verdict directed by the court.
Thank you.
Suppose you had a third question to the juror. Why did you vote to acquit? And the answer was, well, I thought he was guilty, but I just decided we ought to let him go anyway. Would that be, I mean, I'm trying to get over your no cause argument and get to a real retaliation.
In that case, they still haven't given a reason for the acquittal. Was it the statute? Was it something else? I don't know. I would still be hard-pressed to say that.
I just liked the defendant and didn't want him in jail.
I doubt if that would be a sufficient cause, but it certainly would be ridiculous not to strike them peremptorily.
You'd certainly use a peremptory if you had it. All right. Well, this is a rabbit trail. I apologize.
The evils that were prevalent at the time of the genesis of this provision back in England and in the beginning of this country are simply not the same evils today. Those evils gave birth to the system of government and the constitutional system we have today of separated powers, accountable magistrates, popular election and sovereignty, and appeals by right. At that time, there was no remedy for these jurors. There was no remedy for this impropriety. It must be remembered that Bushell did not achieve his liberty in an appeal from that case. At that time, appeals were by leave of the court. Bushell and the jurors had a civil habeas corpus filed and had to work that up by appeal in order to gain their release. At this time, the despotic or tyrannical powers of a judge or a monarch were virtually insulated. That is not the case today. The birth of nullification was birthed by evils that are simply not present today. They are different mischiefs. It is simply not the same difficulty facing us today. A general recognition or even an encouragement of nullification threatens mischief of its own. The prosecutor in every case now will have to defend the validity of the law. Trials will deteriorate into attacks upon the justice of the law, not the facts and the law as it is. This will be made more pernicious if the attacks are against the law on the basis of social science, statistics, and so forth. Then we have a battle of experts. And if the invalidity of the law depends on evidence of a social statistic and so forth, it is probably not the patent the tyranny or patent difficulty and evil that was anticipated to be cured by nullification. We have other means to do that. Such grounds would be raised by a court before trial, and we have appeals and other means to remedy those. It does not depend or need nullification. It would invade the province of the legislature and this court to make and declare what the law is, and also generally encourage contempt and disregard for the court and the legislature.
Let me take you back for just a minute to your emphasis upon the jury's right versus the jury's power. One of the aspects of this appeal is that it challenges not only the rejection of the tendered instruction by the defense, but also the in-trial limitations upon the defense's right to argue jury nullification. Essentially, counsel informed the court, defense counsel informed the court before final argument that he intended, and part of his argument plan was to talk about the jury's power to nullify, and the court wouldn't let him do it. Even if we don't instruct the jury, how can you justify limiting argument of counsel, which by instruction of the court is not the law, allow them to not tell the jury as an advocate of a power that they in fact have and that is recognized under the law?
Again, I think we have to remember that it is an illegitimate power. It's a power that we suffer. It's a risk we take for the protection. It is not a power we need to encourage. It's a price we pay. It is no more a right than is the power to slander somebody in court a right. It is no more a right than the power to shield illegal activity by privilege and immunity is a right to do so.
The problem I'm having with this, it's almost like saying we know we have a right of freedom of speech or freedom of religion, but we don't want to tell people because that's awful powerful. We don't want people to know. So it's like, let's keep it from them, even though the Constitution is pretty clear what it says. But because we are afraid of the exercise of that right, we don't want you to know you have it. That strikes me as very uncomfortable.
If it is a power that is a risk that we're taking, if it is a power that the jury can exercise, and the only reason they, so to speak, get away with it is because it's unreviewable, because we don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater and the protection, then it is not something we should tell the jury. It is something against their oath. It is something that they are deciding the case on other than the law and the facts that they are given. And that's where person's protection lies mainly today, is in the rule of law and not the chance of nullifying the law with which you are charged.
Mr. Secrets, isn't it undoubtedly true that a jury knows that it has this power, right? I mean, a jury knows that when it goes back and the door is closed and it comes up with a decision, that decision is going to stick. And whether they follow the instructions or not, whether they sleep through the whole trial or not, whether they've made the decision before the first witness has taken the stand or not, the jury knows at least at some level of subconsciousness that it can do whatever it wants in the black box of the jury room. Given that that's, I think, undoubtedly so, does it matter whether nullification is argued or not, or would we be better off if just nothing was said about it and this be out there but not talked about?
Well, it is common knowledge, I would submit, that jurors know that if they acquit, nothing happens to them. and we are not informing the jurors of anything they don't already know. I am aware of no interview of a juror that says, we wish we could have just let him go, but we just couldn't.
We thought we'd all be thrown in jail if we did.
Right. They are not even aware of the only consequence to jury service usually against them, which is having to go through interviews and maybe called back for a post-conviction relief action. Jurors know this. This is not a power that they need to be informed about in order to exercise. This is happening across this state. Convictions are refused frequently because the jury just simply either doesn't like the prosecution, doesn't like the law, and they know they can get away with it. That's not something that we should encourage with the sanction of a court or of an opinion. And I don't think that is what the Constitution was intended to do. If a defendant is allowed to attack the justness of a particular law in its specific application to the defendant, even more mischief is created, because now he is able to take advantage of the evidence rules that keep out character evidence to then rely upon the absence of bad character to argue that he is not the person that deserves this harshness. It is not appropriate to him. Fairness would then require the state to reopen the case at that point and put on evidence of the defendant's bad character right in the middle of a final summation, and then presumably come back with a rebuttal argument. It also permits, as the court has pointed out, one juror to hijack the entire jury in deliberations. Instead of addressing the old evils, a modern revival of nullification will produce merely new mischief and the original remedy was never designed to correct. The defendant did attempt to argue nullification. He couches it in the sense of harshness or leniency. The defendant here was not asking for leniency. He was asking for absolution that the jury couldn't give him. He was not asking for a reduction in class. He was asking to go acquit. The defendant, however, never admitted guilt. Nullification presumes guilt. The defendant asserted from start to finish that under the Uniform Commercial Code and other law, he did absolutely nothing wrong. It is fatally inconsistent to seek nullification at the same time you profess your innocence under the facts of the law. The guilty person's vehicle for leniency is the guilty plea. It is not nullification. The court has asked, what does Article 1, Section 19 mean? It means that in Indiana, a criminal case will be tried and the law will be applied by a jury, and the jury's decision to acquit will not subject either the jury or the defendant to further jeopardy. It is within the power of the jury, but it is not within their right, and the defendant cannot invite it by voir dire, instruction, or argument. We ask the court to deny transfer or, in the alternative, affirm the judgment of the trial court. Thank you.
Strauss. Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Sechrist asked this court to issue some ruling that in effect hides the Article 1, Section 19 right that juries have. He supported that request by saying this is an illegitimate power. I cannot see how this can be an illegitimate power if it's embodied in our organizational chart, if it was debated and taken in the context of the history that came up. One of the questions that came up is Mr. Sechrist suggests that we don't have the kinds of tyranny that we need to protect against that we did back in the time of the Magna Carta or Bushell's case. That has not changed the necessity of us having a system in place that protects against the possibility of tyranny. And if the court would look at Supreme Court Justice's Powell's law review article from the 1960s, he's suggesting that we still need to be ever vigilant. What's important is, as Mr. Sechrist said, this creates a situation where we have a government of men and not laws. Well, let's keep in mind that the law in our organizational charter is that our juries decide, and that our people all power is inherent in the people.
What would have been harsh about applying this law to Mr. Holden? If you've been allowed to make this argument, what would it have looked like? What would you have said was unjust about applying the this statute to Mr. Holden?
It goes to the fact of the case that, that if he had any criminal involvement, it was because of his relationship to his mother. His mother was the one that was creating the crime, or at least creating the opportunity for the crime. And in his circumstance, the relationship with his mother caused him to let down his guard on what behavior he's supposed to conform to. So in the context of having four felony forgery charges and two felony theft charges, there was an apparent severity of the prosecution in this case.
You'd have been entitled to argue that to the judge with respect to sentence, wouldn't you? It would be fairly common, in fact, to say to the judge.
And I certainly did.
My person. Yeah.
Right. Right. But I think that it's important to determine that in the application of the guilt phase. One thing that's interesting about the 1851 Constitution is there was a proposal that said in criminal cases, the jury shall determine the facts and the judge shall assess the penalty, and that was rejected. And I would suggest that by failing to take into account the penalty possibility, the jury is then prohibited from considering leniency or the justice of the case in the first place. We have a situation where Mr. Sechrist is concerned about this promoting laws of men and rather the rule of law. Well, take into account that the legislators are all elected. They're all people. They're our neighbors. Those of us who might be wearing black robes are still just people. Many of them are appointed in the trial judges are elected in Marion County. Each of you were appointed in what tries to be a meritocracy, but it has plenty of influence of politics. So we have a possibility that these men are going to make mistakes, and that the system is designed to prevent that from taking course. Now, one of the great things that we may be able to pat ourselves on the back about is that because we have this balance in place where the people have the final say of what's right and wrong, that we have prevented the tyrannies that were so prevalent years ago. And leaving the system in place is a deterrent effect, and I would suggest that it's proper.
Why wasn't the Beavers instruction good enough for you in trial?
The Beavers instruction?
Yes. It comes right out and says the jury, even though it gives some warnings that it ought not to and mm-hmm. should have followed the instructions, but then it ends up saying the jury has the power to go its own way.
It doesn't suggest anything about the justice of the case or considerations of leniency. In addition, I would suggest that the proposal I tendered at trial, which was similar to the Beavers instruction, has some things do not agree with the very fundamental setup of Article 1, Section 19. A jury does have a right to ignore the law if it's just in that case. And we're in Beavers and in my own instruction, we're telling them, you can't ignore the law, but yes, you can. We're in a situation where we're wondering why is it different between the habitual offender type cases in C and Parker. Well, the decision made in C and Parker had to do with the instructions to the court. What we are asking the court to do is issue a statement that says Article 1, Section 19 is a vital part of our Constitution, that the judges should instruct on the scope of that power, and because of that, I think Mr. Holden's conviction should be reversed.
You responded to the Chief Justice's question a few moments ago, saying that it was case-sensitive. This particular defendant had particular cause for your proposed instruction. And in the companion case for today, Riaz, you are also counsel. Well, you submitted the same instruction to Matt, and I was just wondering if it's part of your standard criminal practice to always tender the same now instruction currently, and does that make it all that fact and issue specific?
All right. Your Honor, I just want to remind the court that the time is showing gone. Just to clarify, I was not trial counsel in the Riaz case. I was only appellate counsel, and yes, someone else had asked for the same instruction. I would suggest that the right under Section 19 is a right that applies in any case. Now, whether it has, and that suggests also that we need to have faith in our jurors, that when the facts do not support an exercise of lenience, when the facts do not support a consideration of the justice of the working of government on this particular fact, that we should trust our jury to make the decision that says, oh, we don't need to stray too far from what the instructions of the court were. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bose. The court appreciates the argument this morning, and we'll take the case under submission. As you know, we have not yet acted on the petition to transfer jurisdiction. We will in all probability do that at an early date, and then you will know whether the matter rests as it does with the Court of Appeals decision, or whether you will get a ruling from us on the merits. I'll call to a close the formal part of this morning's hearing and take a few moments to say how pleased we are to be here for the very first time in this splendid new place that the university has supplied to the school. Of course, it's supplied only part of it, the hard work of Dean Norm Westheim and a great many other people, including a heavy list of alumni, helped make it all possible. Dean, we appreciate your hospitality this morning, and congratulations to you on what you and the school have accomplished here. We customarily would retire about now, if we were hearing this argument in our courtroom down the street, to debate what we had just heard and then decide whether to issue an opinion, and if so, we would, before we left the room, in all probability have identified which one of us ought to take on that task. At that moment, if not before, we would have turned to a number of graduates of this school and other schools, an impressive brain trust, I must say, if I do say so myself, who joined us here this morning as our law clerks. We and our clerks in various chambers would be at work on writing an opinion, eliciting any dissents that might exist, and then when everybody had a chance to see what everybody else wanted to say or didn't want to say, if the matter finally come to rest, we sent it to the clerk's office so that the rest of the world knew the answer. One of the changes in the way we do business that's two or three months old now is that sessions like today's, either here or in our courtroom, would be available for anybody to see who had a computer. There are now cameras installed in the chambers of the Supreme Court so that each argument is videotaped. A number of them are webcast live. All of them are archived so that people who have an interest in a particular case or are interested in this case or interested in it because they themselves are involved in a piece of litigation that might be affected by it will have the chance to see what is asked, you know, what is replied by counsel, what counsel's arguments are, and a chance to do that without having to make the trip to Indianapolis. You can see it, of course, since it's on the internet, wherever you are. And frankly, we're still somewhat stunned at the variety of places from which people do, in fact, punch up arguments or decisions. Not just places in Indiana, indeed not just places in the United States, but an astounding list of places overseas where people are interested in decisions or proceedings that occur here in Indiana. It is, I think, a tribute, of course, to the shrinking nature of the world and the fact that, as de Tocqueville observed a very long time ago, almost every issue that arises in American life sooner or later finds its way into an American courtroom. And how it is resolved in one place can affect how it is resolved in another place. And we do all that with the help of good lawyers, like the ones you've heard this morning, and good scholars who write on topics, who help law students become good lawyers, and to think interesting thoughts and to do good research and good writing is absolutely part and parcel of the way courts do business. We often say, as you know, that lawyers are officers of the court. We're never quite sure when we say exactly what that means. But at an absolute minimum, in a all of the obvious professional obligations that lawyers owe to courts. It means that the work that lawyers do is part of the decision that courts make, and how good a job a lawyer does at sharpening up questions or providing a good brief as opposed to a simply ordinary brief makes a tremendous difference in the work that the judges themselves do and what the collective wisdom is at the end of the day. So people who write law journal notes, people who help investigate cases, people who work in clinics, lawyers who contribute both in civil and criminal matters are absolutely officers of the court, part of the official machinery by which justice is either done or not done day in and day out. All five of us have connections to this school and to other schools in the state. Several of my colleagues have and or are teaching here in the school, coming for new courts or for pro bono events or for placement matters, and it is an important connection between the official part of this of the profession and the teaching part of the profession that we involve ourselves and we're invited to be a part of all of those pieces of law school life. We hope we'll have a chance to see all of you again. We'll see you on the internet if we don't see you in person. And we'll look forward to being back in this absolutely magnificent hall many times in the future. As I said, the day the school was dedicated, a law school, quoting somebody else, I might say, stole it fair and square. The law school is upward bound. Let's keep it that way. Thank you all so much for coming today. The court will rise.
Thank you.